This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening. You're tuned in to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed. Today, we're going to feature an interview with Dr. Chris Byrer. He's the immediate past president of the International AIDS Society. He's also professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Byrer was here in KL last month to attend a roundtable discussion on drug policy. It was hosted by the University of Malaya and Institute of Strategic and International Studies. This was done in partnership with Yale University, Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, and The Lancet, a leading journal in the field of medicine. Here is my conversation with Dr. Chris Byrer. Thank you very much for being with us on the program. We're going to be talking about HIV, drug use, drug policy. Back in the day, let's dial it back a few decades perhaps. What got you into this field and what was your interest?
Well, I'm a New Yorker. I started medical school in the early 1980s in New York City, just as the AIDS epidemic was really exploding. And so from the very beginning of my career, I walked into this terrible epidemic. At the time, of course, not only was there no treatment, but there was no diagnostic test. So we diagnosed these patients clinically, and virtually everybody died. It was largely untreatable. Of course, it's still incurable. That was extraordinary. We had, in medicine, pretty much declared the era of great epidemics of infectious diseases over, a thing of the past.
And this thing comes along.
This thing comes along, and of course it devastated the community in New York, family and friends, and so I really have not done anything else in my career, and I've been now fighting this battle for almost 30 years.
And at that juncture, how apparent was it that, you know, it's easy for us to now talk about it in hindsight, about how difficult that period was and how much the epidemic spread in such great numbers, but at the time, were people conscious and aware of it? Was there an awareness of it at all? Or was it much shrouded in ignorance and denial or just...
Well, there was eventually a great deal of awareness. Of course, there was a lot of ignorance because also science was ignorant. I mean, we just didn't know. There was a great deal of unknowns. We had no idea how infectious this was. And then it turned out, happily, that it's not very infectious. And that very specific kinds of behaviors, sexual transmission, needle sharing, or using unsafe injection equipment. And then, of course, you know, we learned over time that there was transmission through pregnancy, that there was transmission through breast milk. Those things we learned later. But I think one thing that nobody was prepared for was until we had the HIV test in the mid-80s and were able to start really looking at populations, that is really when we understood that it already was a global epidemic. Of course, now we understand, you know, that this has been the greatest infectious disease pandemic of modern times, that more than 78 million people have been infected, that we've already had 40 million deaths worldwide, and that really nowhere is spared. And of course, Southeast Asia, this region, turned out to have a very serious epidemic. When I finished my training at Johns Hopkins, that was in 1992, my first position was really setting up the HIV research programs and efforts for Johns Hopkins in Thailand, in Chiang Mai. So I spent the mid-90s, from 92 to 97, based in Thailand, working in the region. I gave lectures here in Malaysia in the mid-90s. Worked in Burma, now Myanmar, in Laos, and in China. And so really, really saw the epidemic unfold in this region. Now, it's close to 20 years later. It is 22 years later. You know, we see there's been tremendous responses, tremendous increases. Malaysia, happily, is one of the countries that has universal access to treatment, to antiviral treatment. And people now diagnosed with HIV infection who are started on antiviral therapy and who are adherent to that medication live an almost normal lifespan. This is no longer a death sentence. That is an enormous change. Where we still have problems in the region is that particularly among what we call key populations, the most vulnerable populations, where there are social, structural, and political issues that continue to be barriers to testing, to treatment, that continue to limit people's ability to protect themselves, there we still see infections.
Were there barriers similar to that in your experience back in the United States as well, those social, political, structural barriers that you had to contend with?
Oh, sure, sure. You know, we've had, for example, a very long struggle in the United States to overcome the political opposition to what's called harm reduction. Harm reduction is really particularly aimed at people whose risks for HIV are from injecting drug use. Harm reduction seeks, of course, to help those people who need and want treatment get into treatment, but also in the meantime to reduce the risk of their acquiring HIV. The principal means for that are needle and syringe exchange programs, providing safe injection equipment, providing, of course, also treatment and care for other infections, sexually transmitted infections, and providing drug treatment for people who are dependent, for example, people who have opioid dependency and are addicted to heroin or other opiates. We had a federal ban on needle and syringe exchange for decades. President Obama finally reversed that. Under intense pressure, the Republicans forced him to go back on that. And now, just in 2015, for the first time, that ban has been lifted. And it's been lifted because we have a new epidemic of heroin use and of injection drug use in rural America, among white Americans, in the red states. And we've had a tremendous increase in overdose deaths, and that has changed our policy. So harm reduction in this region has also been a struggle. Thailand, for many, many years, was a leader in HIV prevention, but would not do needle and syringe exchange. They do provide drug treatment, as Malaysia does, but typically with short courses of methadone that are insufficient and at doses that are too low to help people stay off illicit drugs. Of course, here you have had zero tolerance policies. You have mandatory drug screening, urine screening, mandatory sentencing. The evidence is abundantly clear that detention and incarceration and prison are not effective drug treatment. And in fact, those policies can worsen HIV, viral hepatitis, and tuberculosis spread.
I'm speaking with Dr. Chris Byrer, professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We'll be back after this to talk a bit more about the zero-tolerance approach to drugs in Southeast Asian countries. Stay tuned. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're back on the Evening Edition with me, Ezra Zayed, and today we've been featuring my conversation with Dr. Chris Byrer. He's a leading figure in AIDS research and prevention and a professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So why are we seeing those specific approaches, you know, detention centers, incarceration? Why does that particular approach gain so much traction here in the region?
Part of it has been the association of substance use with crime and with the criminalization of these behaviors. That certainly is a part of the issue. It's also the case that people who use drugs are easy to find and easy to arrest. And so in places where you have arrest quotas, they constantly get picked on. for arrest and detention. When you talk to law enforcement, they will say very often, we are going after the big fish. We're going after the narco traffickers. We're going after the people who are really behind this industry. When you look carefully at the data, and we did that last year for a Johns Hopkins Lancet Commission on Drug Policy and Health, which was published last year just in advance of the UN General Assembly special session on drugs, we interrogated that. We looked very carefully at the global data. It turns out that more than 80%, it's sort of about 84% of all people worldwide incarcerated on drug charges are there just for possession, just for personal use. Now, should we be criminalizing people because they have an addiction problem? The evidence is that, in fact, drug treatment is much more effective and it's much more cost effective. Nobody has any question that we should be trying to control illicit narcotics trafficking and we should be going after the big fish.
Right.
That's not what happens. The people who end up going to jail and having often felony convictions and really have their lives disrupted and in some cases permanently altered such that they find it incredibly hard to finish any kind of education or get any employment. They really have their lives destroyed by these criminalization charges for possession alone.
And yet at the same time, their problems with addiction is not even addressed in any way.
No, that's right. And when you look at the issues of addiction, the outcomes are much better for people in community programs. They're much better, as we all know, in voluntary programs because not everybody is ready to get clean. Not everybody is ready to get off drugs. But when people are, and they've reached that point in their lives where they really feel that they need help and they want to get clean, that's the moment. You really need drug treatment on demand. If you impose it on people who are not ready, the outcomes are poor. The other thing we know is, of course, overdose, particularly with the opiates, is an enormous problem. It's a major cause of loss of life. One of the periods with the highest risk of overdose is right after release from mandatory detention in prison. So if prison was working as a drug treatment approach, you would not see people overdosing upon release.
Yeah.
But in fact, what has happened is they're not getting adequate drug treatment. They are not adequately prepared to get back out into life, and they're extraordinarily vulnerable.
You mentioned the Philippines, and the approach taken by President Duterte is one that is reminiscent of somebody who's watching Netflix and seeing Narcos and seeing the horrors and tragedies that were being experienced not just by communities, but the entire country as a whole. And I'm curious as to why, potentially from your observations, why this approach is desirable by the Filipino administration. And are there any redeeming elements to it that perhaps we're not sort of giving kudos to, or is it just a dated approach?
Well, I really can't speak to the motivations there. I certainly can say that we know empirically that when you use these kind of heavy-handed crackdowns and punitive approaches, you drive people away from services. You drive people into the shadows. You reduce the likelihood that people who do have drug dependency are willing to get into treatment. You have big impacts, and this has been measured in a number of settings, on needle sharing. Because if people are afraid to have clean injection equipment and they're afraid to carry it because of the likelihood of arrest or even of extrajudicial execution, that is going to cause more needle sharing. We know that. We've seen that before. I will tell you that the last time we had a big war on drugs like this in the region was the 2003-2004 period in Thailand. This was former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat implemented this war. And one of the other aspects of that, he called it a law and order campaign, was also that they really went after gay clubs, gay saunas, the same kind of thing that you're seeing in Indonesia right now.
That's right, yeah.
And when they did that, they reversed a very successful Thai policy. The Thai HIV program, the cornerstone of it was something called the 100% condom campaign, which basically mandated that any venue where sex was likely to be sold or exchanged, where people were going, had to have condoms available.
People had access to it in a bathroom, perhaps.
That's right. So they were right there in karaoke's and saunas and nightclubs and obviously.
It's quite innovative.
Yes,
you're acknowledging, what potentially might be a problem, but providing solutions to it.
It's harm reduction. It's harm reduction. And it should be said that prostitution was illegal at the time, and it remains illegal. This was the general agreement was that they were not going to win on trying to change that law. They just leave it alone, but let there be a pragmatic public health approach.
Yeah.
And that's the approach they took. But in the law and order crackdown of 2003, 2004, they used the availability of condoms in the venues for men who have sex with men as evidence of promoting homosexuality. So the condoms disappeared.
Right.
And very predictably, there were significant rises in HIV infection. We can't say that that's absolutely causal, but it's certainly the case that it was not a good public health strategy. It was not evidence-based. I think, it also puts government in a place they don't need to be, right? You don't want a policy that actually interferes with the public health functions of government, right? That is undermining public health practice. We had a similar situation in the U.S. where a number of police forces were targeting what they considered to be kind of streetwalkers and for carrying condoms. Right?
Wow.
And if you have more than three, for example, then
therefore,
that's evidence that you're a sex worker, as opposed to, not nice people don't carry those things.
Right.
So the Ministry of Health and the CDC is encouraging condom use, and clinics are giving out condoms. Be sure to carry enough condoms. And then the police are harassing people for carrying them. So what is the message there?
It's a very strange disconnect.
Indeed. And we actually, the reason we were able to stop that in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia, only in 2012 when we hosted the International AIDS Conference there, and the police became embarrassed that they were actually undermining the HIV response. So these kinds of disconnects are not uncommon. They happen. What we really are trying to do from a public health perspective is say, let's all work together to use the public health evidence to develop policy that makes sense, that protects the population from these kinds of harms, that gets people who need drug treatment into drug treatment. That's our goal. That is everybody's goal. But that also doesn't do harmful things, like locking up people who are not drug dependent, like penalizing people for carrying condoms, like driving drug users underground, shutting down needle and syringe exchanges.
I wanted to talk to you about, connected to this heavy-handed approach that we see globally, in fact, and that how people do end up in prisons.
Yeah.
And prison populations are also at a high risk of HIV infection due to drug use. And maybe you could talk to us about the conditions that facilitate this phenomenon, because I know that you've spent a little bit of time looking at this particular area as well.
Yes. So it's important to say we did a large global project on this in prisons, which was released last year at the International AIDS Conference. And this was in the global health journal, The Lancet, which is kind of the leading journal in the field. And we looked across the board at prevention, treatment, care for not just HIV, but HIV, viral hepatitis, hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and tuberculosis. Because in many parts of the world, actually, there's more prison-associated TB than HIV. And it's a real problem. TB in prisons and prisoners, of course, also affects guards and everybody else because it's an airborne infection. And what you see there is that there is a great deal of TB transmission in a number of countries and settings because, first of all, people are not adequately screened. People who are detained, particularly in remand and in jail, so they're waiting trial. They haven't seen a judge yet. And they're very often are denied medical care, don't have access to medical care. So there's a lot of TB there. And then, of course, there's overcrowding. prisons all over the world are overcrowded. There's poor ventilation, and there's undernutrition. Now, in some countries in this region, and still true, for example, in Burma, prisoners are not fed adequately. If you don't have family members bringing you extra food, you will really suffer malnutrition in incarceration. And that is a serious problem. I was just a few months ago in Michina, in the capital of Kachin State, which is the northernmost province in Myanmar. It's right on the border with China. It's got a huge amount of heroin. The prison there was originally built, I think it was for 1,200 people, or maybe 1,400 people in the British era. It has over 3,000 people. It is extraordinarily overcrowded, inadequate nutrition, inadequate ventilation. So TB is an explosive problem there, as is drug-resistant TB because of the interruptions of treatment. Hepatitis is different. Hepatitis, particularly hepatitis C, is very easily transmitted through needle sharing, but also through things like tattooing and piercing, which is very, very common in prisons and prisoners. A number of countries have implemented harm reduction and basically saying, okay, people are allowed to have tattoos in prison. It has to be done by somebody with training, with sterile equipment. When you look across Asia, you don't really see any of that. People are having a very high exposure. So actually, in terms of transmission in prison, that's the most important virus. HIV, there is some transmission in prison, but what we see more as a problem is, first of all, that people who are living with HIV often don't get treated in prison. So that's a real problem. But if they do, they often have treatment interruptions after release, because there are not programs to connect people. That's been a huge problem in the United States. And what we know now, which we didn't know in the past, is that if you are living with HIV and you are successfully treated, you are not infectious. Right? Treatment is prevention. It dramatically reduces infectiousness. If you have a treatment interruption, you stop taking your drugs or you don't have access to your drugs, the virus comes roaring back. And you become infectious again for sex partners or husbands, wives, so forth. So that is a real problem. And it turns out that that's one of the biggest issues with incarceration. Now, why are these infections so related to prison? That is also because who is going to prison? So, again, when we look in this country, more than 60% of all your prisoners are there for substance use.
60%?
Yes. So there's no question that obviously those people are also more likely to have HIV, viral hepatitis. The critical thing, first of all, is that so many of those people, if they only have substance use issues, only there for possession, do not need to be in prison, right? I mean, that, you know, the first thing you want to do is reduce the number of people in prison. Secondly, if people have committed serious crimes and are in prison but have drug dependency, they need treatment. And they need treatment while they're in prison, and they need treatment on the way out of prison. Thirdly, obviously, the issues of overcrowding, inadequate nutrition, inadequate ventilation that aid and abet TB spread have to be addressed. And a lot of those are structural. You can't really be using, as people in Burma are, for example, prisons built in the 1860s.
Yeah.
They just are not adequate for human life.
That's Dr. Chris Byrer from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And after this, we'll talk about a breakthrough program in AIDS prevention and why many countries are still reluctant to implement it, despite how effective it's been. Stay tuned to the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Bigotry Free Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the evening edition. I'm Ezra Zayed, and we've been featuring Dr. Chris Byrer. He's the immediate past president of the International AIDS Society and professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
At this juncture, with the amount of data and research that has taken place, you mentioned that when it comes to the development of this issue on HIV, there's been great strides over the past 20 years. Can you identify some of the key areas in terms of the obstacles that either are being faced in this region or still in the West?
So just as I said, first of all, the policies, practices, and procedures around criminalization of drug use and the limitations on harm reduction, the limitations on needle and syringe exchange, the limitations on drug treatment, that has really aided and abetted the HIV epidemic among people who use drugs. There's no question about that. The second area that we're very concerned about is across this region, but actually it's also true globally. It's true in my country, in the U.S., but we're really seeing this in Malaysia, in Thailand, in China substantially, that there is a ongoing epidemic among young men who have sex with men. Now, the best news is that we have a new prevention tool. It's called PrEP. Pre-exposure prophylaxis, which is the use of antiviral drugs to prevent HIV infection in somebody who is not living with the virus but who is at risk. And this turns out to be remarkably effective. It's the most effective tool we have to prevent spread. It's also recommended for what are called discordant couples, where one is living with HIV and the partner is not infected. That uninfected partner can also go on PrEP. And it virtually takes to zero the risk of HIV infection if the person is adherent to the medication.
That sounds like a huge breakthrough.
It is a huge breakthrough. It is the biggest breakthrough in prevention that we've had. I'm sorry to tell you that that breakthrough happened in 2011, so it's 6 years ago,
right.
And we are still struggling in the region. So I just came from the regional HIV meeting in Hong Kong. Hong Kong also is seeing a serious epidemic in young men who have sex with men. And I was talking with the director of Hong Kong's HIV program, and I said, so, are you going to be doing PrEP? Oh, we need to do a demonstration project first in Hong Kong to see how it's going to work. Okay, well, did you want to start that in 2011? It's 2017. Why are we waiting so long, right? Thailand now has approved PrEP for use for HIV prevention, but not in their national health system. So people have to pay for it out of pocket. There is some out-of-pocket PrEP happening here, and there's apparently going to be now some new demonstration projects around PrEP that are going to be tailored for MSM and transgender women. So those are steps in the right direction. But, you know, we expected when we had this new intervention that we
would... For people
would,
to just
absolutely.
Open their arms and take to this, but not so much.
Well, it's governments that have it. People are ready to do it.
Yeah.
It's ministries of health and national AIDS programs that have been slower, and it's the regulatory bodies.
The reluctance is based on what?
Well, I think several things. One certainly is that at least in the middle and upper income countries, these drugs are still not cheap.
Yep.
The prices need to come down. The main drug that is used is a two-drug combination. It's called Truvada. And the two drugs in it are tenofovir and emtricitabine. These are drugs that are widely used in treatment. In lower-income countries, they're available as generics. India manufactures them, Thailand manufactures them, and they're really cheap. My understanding is that the price is about to come down significantly in Malaysia. So that would be, that's one barrier, has been cost. Secondly, there has been a kind of conservative reluctance. It's very similar to what we used to hear with the birth control pill. Well, you know, if women have access to this pill that prevents pregnancy, sexual risk-taking will increase. So everybody's very worried about that. We have looked very carefully at that issue, and at least in the well-done studies, there has not been much in the way of increased risks with PrEP. But that is a concern of policymakers, and it's one where we keep trying with the evidence to show that it's not the case. I think there's also, I will say, at least in some countries and in some settings, a reluctance to implement this policy because of a feeling that gay men who have sex with men, are somehow to blame for their HIV risks. There's a stigma there. And for example, I was invited to give a major speech, a keynote at China's National AIDS meeting in 2015, and I had the opportunity to meet with one of the very senior political leaders there who was going to be making this decision. He said, what should we do to address HIV in our country? And
right.
I said, you have to treat the people living with HIV. That means also much more widespread testing. And you have to implement PrEP for high-risk people, including men who have sex with men. And his answer to me was basically, why won't they just use condoms? Well,
wow.
And it turns out that condoms are necessary, but insufficient.
And just looking at, I guess, this discussion of stigma, you know, by and large, it is still very much part of at least Malaysian society.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst I remember, you know, awareness campaigns on television and newspapers, even as early as maybe the 90s, there is still huge strides have been made by the Malaysian AIDS Council.
Yes.
There is, when it comes to the implementation of some of these measures and the discussions of it within respective communities, we're still speaking about it and sometimes in hushed tones.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what progress or what parallels can we observe in other neighboring countries with similar cultures, perhaps, that have made it easier for people to be a little bit more open about this and less judgmental about the particular issue?
Well, I think it's a very important question. I mean, certainly one thing to say is that when you look across the region, you can see that many of the communities are more organized, more outspoken, are really standing up. So, for example, in the early 90s when I was working in Thailand, there were not a lot of organized groups of sex workers pressing for their rights. Now, a current collaboration that we have working on PrEP in Bangkok is a partner with a terrific organization, a SWING, that is a sex worker union that includes men, women, and transgender persons engaged in the sex industry. And they are very much partners in prevention, partners in programming. They have support from USAID, from PEPFAR. They collaborate with the Thai Ministry of Health. I mean, it really...
It's quite vibrant.
Yes, and it's extraordinarily impressive how mainstream they have become. But, you know, at the same time, of course, there are some situations that are very concerning. So the change in policy in the Philippines with this war on drugs, which Human Rights Watch has noted is really more of a program of extrajudicial killing in poor neighborhoods and where people are being accused of being drug dealers. Who knows? None of this is being adjudicated with the rule of law. Now, nobody's being charged with anything. And it's sort of extra military, extra police kind of irregulars who are doing the killing. This is lawlessness. And of course, it has an enormously negative impact on people's willingness to come forward, to get tested. You wouldn't enter drug treatment in a scene like that, and neither would I. So those are the kinds of things that undermine public health and that have an enormously negative impact on these epidemics.
Final question.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, you've spent a lot of time in this region, you know, be it this country and our neighboring areas. What are you most optimistic about?
Well, I think I find the young people and the young professionals of this region are such a dynamic, exciting group of people, women and men. They're a tolerant generation. They're smart. They're very savvy. It's interesting, you know, there's so many governments are still trying to restrict media and restrict information
right.
and contain this generation. I don't think they can be contained. They are they're so impressive, and I think, you know, study after study has shown that they are tolerant, an extraordinarily tolerant generation, a very different gender dynamics, much more equalitarian between men and women, and so I think the future is bright if your generation moves into leadership, which is inevitably going to happen. I find that really exciting. And I think the Asia Pacific is a very young region, as you know, and a very dynamic one. And, you know, let them step up, because I think your generation is ready to lead.
There's light at the end of the tunnel.
No, there's no question.
Dr. Chris Byra, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Dr. Chris Byra from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. If you missed any part of this interview, you can download the podcast from our BFM app, and that's available on the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Ezra Zayed on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.